Good morning. This is Dr. Matthew Dunn. My guest today on the future of email is Sam Safey of Revenue Labs, zooming in all the way from London. Good afternoon, Sam. How are you?
Hey, how's it going, Matt? Good afternoon. Good morning for you. Thank you so much for having me on, Matt. And yeah, really, really excited to dive in and share some cool stories.
You know, for some reason, the UK is like this hot spot for email and email marketing. An undue proportion of people that I've had a chance to meet and have a chance to have on this podcast have been from the UK. Why? What do you think?
I think it's something in our tap water, Matt, that makes us love makes us love email. No, I think the marketing industry in general is rapidly growing globally, especially because you see all of these new faces coming up and new marketers, especially people that are teaching, you know, course creators. And I think the economy, as we can clearly see, is shifting. That bug has been caught in the UK as well. And I think now people are starting to realize that, hey, like, you know, there are other areas to explore rather than maybe what was first seen as traditional, you know, the traditional career path. And marketing is something that helps you exercise your creativity as well as, you know, the numerical side to it too. So
why do you think marketing, I agree with the observation and I've got my own thoughts, but marketing growing, why?
It's a good question. I think, you know, with tools like Shopify, right, that are rapidly growing, I think there's never been a better time where people are more empowered to start their own businesses. And I think the moment people enter the arena and kind of start their own business, the first thing they realize is, okay, I need customers. That generally creates the need of, okay, well, I need to learn how to market and, you know, be top of mind. And, you know, a lot of people think marketing is just literally just, you know, driving sales, but a lot of it is like top of mind awareness, you know, working the funnel. So yeah, it's pretty much why.
Well, good. I'm glad we can talk about Shopify. Now, your company, Revenue Labs, is it fair to say an agency fundamentally?
Yeah, so we operate as a boutique agency. So I like to say we're not big enough to the point where you're going to get lost or a client would get lost in the service, but we're just compact enough so people get that, you know, white glove service. But yeah, we are a retention agency.
And do you focus mostly on, because you mentioned Shopify, do you focus mostly on direct-to-consumer kind of brands?
Exactly, yeah. So we work with DTC brands primarily.
Okay, and then give me the geographic split for customers, your customers.
Yeah, interesting. So the vast majority of our customers sell into the US.
Okay.
I think about 60% are also based in the US, but we have some entrepreneurs that are based in Thailand and on the other side of the world as well. But they mostly sell into the US as well. So it's pretty diverse, if you ask me.
Interesting. It sells into the US. And I know I think it's still the biggest economy measured by whatever you want to measure that by. And there's certainly a place where email, which I think we'll probably end up talking about, is used a lot. But it's an intriguing moment in the world that you can be sitting somewhere in like Thailand and say, I think I'll start a direct consumer brand and sell into the US. Wow. Right?
I know.
None of this was possible not that long ago.
100%. And you know what's, I think the reason the US market is so ahead of the rest of the world, in my opinion, is because Amazon has created a beautiful ecosystem where, you know, all of your orders are communicated via email, or the updates are communicated via email. So people are naturally very used to just looking at their email for orders, updates, and offers. Yeah. So that's what the DTC world has kind of jumped into.
Your feeling is that happened faster, earlier in the US, and Amazon played a big role?
100% in terms of making the customer already comfortable with shopping via email and trusting the channel itself.
Yeah, trusting the channel. Yeah, I get to brag or flash my gray hair or something. My Amazon account is over 25 years old.
Wow.
I've lived in Seattle. I still live close to Seattle, but I lived in Seattle. I'm an early adopter for sure. I heard about this crazy company selling books, and they had me books, right? And I've never been concerned about things like adopting the new, but 97, 96 was pretty early to buy something on the web.
Imagine.
Yeah. And I look at what they've done since then. And then the explosion of, I think, a really important counterbalancing ecosystem in Shopify. And it's remarkable. And then now, you know, I live out in the woods and I see Amazon trucks go by. I'm like, whoa, it's really, we're living in the future. What's next? George Jetson's car becoming a suitcase.
Yeah.
You probably don't know the reference, but okay. What got you interested in marketing?
Yeah, good question, Matt. So I was actually working a corporate job in sales. So, I think the biggest stat in my life currently is how many times I've been had profanity used against me from CFOs because I was a funny story. So I was a cold caller, right? And I'd call CFOs to sell FX services. And yeah. FX is pretty much seen as the toilet of finance.
Okay.
So that's where I got my story started. And during that time, I think it was like 4, 5, 6 months, I had to make 100 cold calls a day. So that really taught me assiduity. It taught me work ethic. Exactly. Yeah. So when you have to sit down and grind 100 sales calls a day, you know, it kind of brings out this inner hunter in you in a strange sense, right? So as I was doing that, I quickly did a calculation and I'm like, I can't even afford a down payment on this salary in the next 50 years, let alone pay off a mortgage. So, I was very lucky to be exposed to a few people early on in my journey. I don't know if you know Iman Gadzi. He's somebody that I actually knew here in London when he was 16, building everything he was building. So he kind of helped me understand, let's say, what was possible in the online world. So following that, I was Googling during my lunchtime at work how to make money online, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And that sent me down a rabbit hole. I got I remember getting a YouTube video from someone called Alex Cotone, and that was the program I ended up investing in to learn copywriting. Mm-hmm. And that was my start into learning marketing. So I started off as a copywriter.
Okay, not an easy thing to do, copywriting.
Yeah, it's definitely not for me.
Backtrack to the sort of boiler room calling for a second, because that's an interesting thing to have done. Obviously not an easy thing to have done, but I had one of those calls yesterday, you know, middle of the day. I'm working my tail off, phone rings. I make the mistake of picking it up, right? And it goes right into the script. And I was, you know, I was irked. I'm like, you didn't even ask me whether I had time for this conversation. And I'm sure quota of stuff to pound out. But why do you think companies still do that?
I think it's a volume game. I think when it comes to cold calling, there's two approaches. Number one, I think you're looking for that 3% of audience that is ready to buy now and potentially looking for a solution.
Okay.
Number two, I think it's also how you approach a sales call. So most people would go into the pitch or anything. What I used to like to do was I used to like to ask, like, hey, is this Matthew? And then I would ask or confirm whether they're the right person in the position I'm speaking to. Because that way they don't know if it's, you know, a sales call or not, right? You're just confirming. So the reason why companies still use it, in my opinion, is it still does work, you know, to some degree. Maybe less so as it used to, though.
Okay. I mean, it's kind of the opposite of marketing. In that, right? If marketing, who is it? I'm blanking on where the quote came from. But, you know, true marketing is knowing your customer's needs so well. That what you do really solves the problem. You don't need to sell them. If you truly understand what they need and what problem you can lift off of their shoulders, like they'll like say, give it to me. Here's an example. Amazon doesn't have to do that much marketing to get people to use Amazon. Honestly.
Correct.
Why? Because it's a lot better to have it show up on the doorstep than drive to town to buy it. It's a lot easier to say, wait a minute, somewhere in the universe, someone must have a left-handed monkey ranch. Oh, I'll just go search Amazon. Oh, look, left-handed monkey ranch, and it'll show up, right? So you jump from the one side over to the other side. What, aside from copywriting, which is a hard skill to learn, what was the biggest thing you had to, you know, get in your head about helping your customers as a marketing expert?
Yeah, good question. I think from a copywriting perspective, it was just really getting a deep understanding of customers. And I think there's a a gold mine that I used to use when I was a copywriter. It was something called Google Discussions, which was it's like an extension, right? And whatever topic I type in, if I hit the discussions tab, it would load all of the forums pertaining to that topic.
Yeah.
So I would go in and I would actually read articles of what real people are writing and complaining about. Because when you're in forums,
ending your market. You know, there you go. Okay.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So just the different ways where you can really gather information, for example, through forums, because forums are normally anonymous. People kind of go there to journal their really deep thoughts. So when you really, and then when you read enough of these articles or, you know, enough of these posts, there's like a very thematic experience where you start to see like, okay, like this, these three areas are recurring in 70% of the posts I read. So if I can 80-20 my writing to target those, you know, three core areas, for example, I'm now deeply appealing to a vast variety of people. Because again, you can't appeal to everyone, but you can definitely appeal to the majority.
Yeah. Very, very smart. Sort of the forum as a bit of an x-ray into the mind of the market.
Exactly. And then the next bit is structure. So once you have the info, how do you structure that information? And then how do you deliver it to your client? And that's where I think results happen in email and copy in general.
How early did email sort of click as the channel that you thought would be effective to focus on? Because it's right on top of your LinkedIn, says email and SMS. Like, how early did you go, that's the right one?
Yeah. Good question. So when I started copy, obviously there's different types of copy. There's ad writing, there's sales page writing, landing, like the whole lot, right? And even before my sales job, I was looking into internet marketing because I think at that time it was like booming, right? So at that point I was just a pure consumer of information, and I would read all of these emails, but I didn't realize that there was like, it didn't click to me that there's someone actually writing this and getting paid on the other end for it. I thought the business owner was doing it, right? I didn't really understand how things worked behind the scenes. So I actually got my start in email itself, and that was the channel I chose because sales pages were way too long. They took ages of research and then structure. And I guess there was an inherent lazy side where I was just like, what can I do fast and impactful? And I can just do it, repeat, right? Mm-hmm. And email seemed the most, let's say, franchisable thing to do because you're writing short skits, sprint stories, little value. Your job as an email writer isn't to sell. It's to usher somebody and pique their interest to take them to the place where they're going to be sold to, right?
Right.
So,
it's the conduit. It's the conduit, not the the spigot, so to speak, right?
Exactly. And when I saw what email can do from a channel perspective, I was just like, this seems incredible. It's trackable, you know. It's scalable, and as somebody's list grows, you can attribute revenue to the things you write. So, I really liked that part of it.
Nice, interesting, and writing skills, copywriting skills, way undervalued in email. It's not just about hitting send over and over. If you don't have something to say in that message, people sniff that out really fast and just ignore it, delete it, unsubscribe from it, right?
Exactly.
So working with the kind of DeepSea and Shopify-based brands that I think you're targeting, you must end up touching Klaviyo quite a bit.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Klaviyo. We live on Klaviyo. You think I'd know, right?
Yeah. I've heard both, so I'm pretty. Okay. I'm at a 50-50%. But I say Klaviyo. I used to say Klaviyo, but now I say Klaviyo.
Okay, Klaviyo. We'll go with Klaviyo. So, fairly common system for your customers to have their lists on. Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Exactly. So they will have the list, and then we would go in and just nurture that list and maximize the potential from the list.
Yep. And one of the things about that ecosystem, let's see if I can say this succinctly, relatively small brands, relatively small D2C companies, from what I've seen talking to a lot of people in this space, frequently have a better ecosystem with a better marriage between their commerce platform and their email platform because Shopify and Klaviyo talk back and forth very, very well. And without naming names, you can spend a zillion, big brands do spend zillions on really large ESP platforms that don't have that kind of tight, what did the customer do and what did they do last week and what's their history? Those kind of tight links. Frequently, the ESP is its own little lonely silo with nothing but email information, which I think would make the job harder. Klaviyo, Shopify, you tend to have a pretty good view, my understanding at least, you tend to have a pretty good view of the results of the email and the commerce activity, and it's the same customer, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're, because of their APIs, it passes along data really, really well. So I always say, right, like one thing about DTC email specifically that I love is it literally nurtures both sides of your brain. So the left side, right side, the left side, like, you know, one side for creativity where you're looking at visuals and, you know, like beautiful art. And then the other side, which is the data. I forgot which side pertains to which, but you know what I mean? Like the data tells you how good your creatives are. So
yeah. Really okay. Okay. So you end up diving into left and right brain for your accounts, obviously.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, you know, the EOS principle, visionary integrator, right? You have a visionary in you, and we all do to some degree. It's about visualizing, okay, like what can I add in this customer journey and where can I add it? And that unleashes like your inner artist, right? And then the other side is your integrator, where you're actually diving in and you're like, okay, how did this perform? What are the numbers telling me? What's the picture that's being painted? Mm-hmm. And then you can make decisions based on that.
Got it. Okay. See, email's a lot more fun than people think it is.
It is.
You also work with SMS, right?
We do. Yes. So we do SMS as well as email. That's a channel that's coming up now. Very much so.
That's what I was going to ask you about. What do you think? What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, very interesting question. So SMS at the moment is a brilliant channel, very high ROI. Yeah. One thing I'm noticing is in Europe, maybe SMS is not as effective as it is in America, because in Europe, right, we use WhatsApp a lot more than text. Yep. Exactly. So I think WhatsApp is definitely more of a channel to focus on in the future for a European or Middle Eastern market. Mm-hmm. And then when you go into the States, you know, everyone in the States communicates via, you know, iMessage or something of that sort. So I think text works well there, because that's what they're used to do as well in America.
And fill in a gap for me. If you have customer focuses in Europe as a market or Middle East, how rich is WhatsApp as a marketing channel? Can you do more than just text messages on WhatsApp as a marketing channel?
Yeah. So I think to be totally transparent, I haven't really dived very deep into WhatsApp yet. It's something that I have my eye on, but one thing I do know about it is it allows for multiple types of media. Like, you know, on WhatsApp, you send your friends images and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You can be very creative with it. It's a very similar channel. It's just, you know, more intimate based on the region, really.
Yeah. I've got relatives and friends in Europe, and for sure you go, you know, oh, them? Yeah, WhatsApp. Not, as you said, the iMessage or whatever comment, I want to follow that thread a bit. U.S. experience, and there's great historical accidents why this is the case, and U.S. experience being SMS-centric has led to the blue bubble and green bubble camps, right? The iPhone's the dominant mobile platform here, but it's not 100%. And the messaging experience between iPhone to iPhone and iPhone to anything else, the first one is relatively rich, and you can do things like media and videos and images. But the minute you've got other people involved on other platforms, it kind of falls apart. And really, the fundamental common layer is still straight up ASCII text messages. I subscribe to a couple of brands. I actually like their T-shirts, among other things. Text messages, partially as a professional experiment. What are these guys going to do? And the content's pretty piss poor.
Yeah.
It tends to be, look, another sale. Hey, great sale. Got a sale going. Like, wow, that's all you think to do. And it's straight ASCII text. There's no rich media. There's no video. There's no anything. That could change this year if Apple's support of RCS, Rich Communication System standard, which Google has been pushing for a couple of years now, if Apple's pretty robust about how they talk to SMS, messaging market in the US could suddenly become viably rich and interesting and not quite such a husky telegraph style channel. I think it could be kind of explosive if it's actually a robust experience. And I think email marketers are really well positioned to understand what to do with that channel.
With SMS.
Reactions?
Yeah. Yeah, no, 100%. I think there's a lot of limitations with SMS at the moment in terms of the characters. And, you know, if you look around, most brands' playbook is just use SMS as a supplement, you know, for your email and just, you know, shoot out a sale every now and then when you have it, right? You know, by nature of the channel and the limitations, you kind of have to be very direct because you don't have a lot of room to play around.
Yes.
But I think what you could do with SMS is make it more of an experiential, I don't know if you can say experiential experience, but you know, you can do like product treasure hunts and you could gamify the whole thing. You could have SMSs pretend like being sent from different people in your team who are fighting to give you a better price. Like, you know, you could really, really think outside of the box when it comes to SMSs. Because when you think of the base, SMS is a channel that is coming usually from your friend, right? Your friend normally texts you. Yeah. So how can we get that understanding of what the channel is already used for, play on those emotions, and then create marketing experiences out of that? This is where I see it going in the future, personally.
Interesting. And actually, that's a much more fun vision. And hey, another sale. I mean, my observation about the few brands that I allow SMS from, word used intentionally, is that they basically trained me to wait. Like, if I need, you know, if I need more socks, I'm not going to jump on their store and buy socks. I'll wait a week. I'll wait 2 weeks. Sooner or later, they'll go, hey, we've got a sale on socks. And I'll go, cool, right? No. Pull the trigger. And they I'm sure they're conscious about that. I'm sure there's a loyal customer worth more kind of thing. But seriously, they just trained me to wait for the cycle to come around. And that ASCII only, text only, really short message experience, it is hard to vary that. It is hard to find a tone that's not just interruptive, kind of peremptory, sale and immediate action focused. But I can't imagine that many people will tolerate, you know, lots and lots of brands pinging their phone with that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Once you sign up to too many brands, you know, it can definitely get annoying, which is
noisy.
Why. Yeah. Exactly. Which is why I think the only way to stand out is do something different and think outside the box, because the competition is pretty low at the moment. Like, I think you and I both know that in terms of SMS content.
It really is. And it is. Cost part of that. My understanding is that text messaging is pretty especially expensive in the market where you live. I mean, it's expensive in the US, but it's really expensive in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, it's I think that's another factor as well in terms of how expensive it is. If you have a big list, it can cost you a bit to push it out. The ROI is there, but again, it's like a lot of brands are just a bit hesitant. Because it's not as proven. But then you hear stories of people, you know, like I think Van Oaks on a podcast was saying for every dollar he spends, he gets like $12 back. So I think there is a lot of interest in this space. But for some reason, brands aren't really pushing onto it as much as you'd imagine. It's not got the adoption you'd imagine it would get, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear you say it. I'm not surprised that you've got the same observation, because it's talked about, but they're still kind of, I don't know, maybe partially because there is a price tag, right? If you made a big mistake with a big list, it'd be an expensive lesson. You make a big mistake with an email list, it's a relatively inexpensive lesson.
Exactly, 100%. Yeah. And then also there's the idea of you're sending either, you know, if you're sending pure text, it's obviously a bit cheaper, but then the moment you want to start adding creatives in, it now turns into an MMS, right? So now you're spending more. Per MMS. So some clients are just like, okay, or some brands would generally be a bit hesitant. But in my opinion, I think every brand should give it a try, because if it doesn't work, you can cut it off and, you know, like you don't have to run a massive test. I mean, you know, the upside is some incredible ROI and, you know, you test it with a small cohort. The downside is you just don't use it. It doesn't work. So yeah, I think definitely it's worth a swing.
Worth a swing, and worth, I think, stepping back and saying, how do these two channels play off each other, coexist, rather than you know, sort of compete for volume. I got my wife a present for her upcoming birthday. Hey, she can't hear. I got my wife a present for her upcoming birthday, and the place I bought it sent the order confirmation via text. Okay. So I've got an email, you know, but I think it was a package tracking update ping yesterday. Like, okay, I'm actually kind of glad to know that the thing's going to get here on time. That was the right use of that channel. Correct. I didn't need the receipt via text. I got that in email. Sounds like a pretty good balance to me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what's the best used at the moment as a supplementary channel. So for example, I would personally use SMS from an 80-20 perspective. What are the 20% of messages that are urgent that make up the biggest leverage across 80% of the funnel? So for example, if you add something to cart, if someone subscribed to SMS, it's probably better to send them an SMS reminder for the add to cart, followed by an email, because it's more urgent, right?
Right.
You'll get more eyes. So in this case, if someone's added to cart, that's a high level of intent. They're raising their hands saying they want your product, right? Mm-hmm. So sending an SMS in that situation, that's where you can really leverage it, right? On top of that, with a campaign, if I send out an email campaign and there's a certain cohort of people that will not open it, following up those people with an SMS, as long as it's an important sale, see how you're now not annoying people? You're kind of, if you don't see me here, maybe you'll see me here. Yeah. More that kind of approach.
That's a very sophisticated move that you might be able to do in a Shopify Klaviyo world, but literally knowing who opened fast enough, knowing who didn't open fast enough to follow up with a text, that's hard at scale in a lot of systems, unfortunately. Kudos to you for getting to play on the play with the really cool toys.
Yeah, no, definitely. The beauty is let's say our first abandoned cart email is scheduled to go out 30 minutes after someone abandons their cart, right?
We always
test with times. Every store will be different based on what's the optimal time. That's where split tests come in. Yeah. In this case, what we'll say is, okay, let's trial half an hour. So if someone has not opened, and this is the beauty with ESPs, right? Klaviyo, a lot of ESPs have this ability. So if someone has not opened an email in 30 minutes, send SMS. So you build it off logic, which is really fun.
Okay. Talk to me a bit about growing your agency. I mean, you're successfully in this space now. As you look back over 2 years, I think that you've had this running. What are some of the big lessons? I wish I'd have done this different, or I'm glad I did that.
Yeah, a great question. So, one thing I'm glad I did was I didn't dive straight into doing an agency. The fact that I did copy first gave me an understanding of the nitty-gritty of marketing itself, so I could leverage that knowledge to actually build the agency. The second thing that I did was I didn't start an agency. I actually started by white labeling somebody else's service when I was totally new in the space. Because I wanted to make sure that I saw how things were done correctly from a functioning perspective before I would go out on my own and do it.
Okay.
And it was actually my first ever mentor. I would have an agency, right, with our own website, and then we would find the clients, and then basically he would do the fulfillment of the results. And that's exactly how I got my start.
Okay.
And then I told him that my goal is in the next 3 or 4 months to make my own thing and, you know, have our own fulfillment team. So after, I'd say it was 5 or 6 months, it was pretty much time to go at it. Mm-hmm. And by that time, what I had learned is, you know, understanding how to actually sell and understand people's problems from a very deep perspective when it comes to email. So that multiplied by continuous repetition really helped grow. And then I could identify the right team to take us to kind of where we are today, right?
Okay.
In terms of lessons that I've learned, number one, from an agency perspective, the biggest leverage you can have is looking after your clients. Because if you build a good base of clients and you look after them well, you will never technically have to hunt for business. It just becomes a luxury, right? There is a little bit of an asterisk there, because in an agency, there is, you know, churn is part of the game. So what I say is sometimes you'd sign on a client that might be struggling on their front end And as an email agency, we don't really have much control over their advertising, right? Sometimes it's budget. And sometimes, you know, I always say sometimes brand owners are their own worst enemies because they have a certain notion of how things should work, but the reality kind of dictates otherwise. So when you boil all of these concepts together, I'd say pillar number one is always prospect and always, you know, do your marketing and stay top of mind because you always want to be putting your name out there and never stopping. Number two, don't fall in love with the paycheck, fall in love with the client. When you can do that, it is, you know, and this was actually a quote from my first copywriting mentor. And this is what he had put in a Google Doc. He said, don't fall in love with the paycheck, fall in love with the client. And that has been my mantra pretty much moving forward.
Nice.
There was a period of time, Matthew, where I did stop prospecting. Mm-hmm. And the only way that we were getting customers was through referrals of doing a good job. And that's when I realized the power. Like in the first half of building the agency, it was just through word of mouth, doing a good job, clients introducing us to their friends, and then partners introducing us to more of their clients because we did such a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And now the goal is to really, you know, start the acquisition side of things. Mm-hmm. But the beauty is we proved concept. Our retention rate ourselves as a retention agency is over 18 to 20 months, just keeping somebody on board and counting. So,
and counting. Yeah. Have you ever fired a client?
We have actually fired a client. And I think the time we fire a client, right, is when there's a discrepancy. When somebody hires us, we're the expert and they've hired us because their channel isn't working. I think it's kind of tough to work specifically with a client who hires you and then tells you what to do, if that makes sense.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. But quite transparently, those are the relationships that tend to, you know, not work out long term because you're not allowed to operate in your zone of genius, which is what you've been brought in to do. Yeah. So if we have fired a client, that would pretty much be the predominant reason.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Different kind of agency, but I've had the same experience in the same conversation. Like, you know, look, you're paying us because we actually know how to do this. And if you want me to just take dictation, sorry, I'm overqualified. See ya.
Exactly. It's an empowering feeling, right? In a weird way, like, you know, it's an empowering feeling to be able to walk away from a relationship that you see no fruit for both parties, right? Not just for you, not just for them.
It's better, right? It's better for both sides in the long run, because someone who can't take their hands off, like, would you do this for the surgeon work, you know, operating on you? No, cut there, because I think that's where it should be.
Exactly.
It's funny. Yeah. And congrats, by the way, like that's a heck of a long retention cycle to have. Thank you. I suspect it'll keep going up from how you're approaching stuff. Fall in love with the client, not the paycheck. I quite like that mantra.
Thank you.
How do you find customers in a different geography? Is that a challenge? You're in the UK, you got customers in the US, a lot of them, right?
A lot of them, yeah. To be honest, the world is online, right? I kind of see online as one country all in itself. Like, we're all positioned in different areas, but we all kind of commune to the same place, right? So when you're on LinkedIn, you know, someone can be anywhere around the world, but we're all on the same platform and the same interface.
Yeah, that's true.
So like when also it's like, as I've embarked on this journey of entrepreneurship, I've made a lot of friends and colleagues and, you know, incredible people based all around the world. And then funny part is when you actually present yourself well in front of them, you actually establish a real connection. You know, now there's a lot of business opportunities that come from that as well. So, you know, partnerships are a massive way for agencies to grow. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, our partners are incredible. And I don't think, distance or country has ever come between that, really.
It's heartening, right? That you can establish, grow, build really, really solid relationships that both parties gain from, and ignore the geographic boundary. Again, this wasn't possible 20 years ago, right?
100%.
You know, we're sitting here across multiple time zones having a face-to-face conversation.
Exactly. Looking at this here.
And, right, and like, dang, that's cool.
100%. I was actually part of an agency group where there was a few agency owners. And I remember I typed in a message looking for a developer because one of our clients needed a developer to fix their landing page. A few people reached out. There was one specific person that reached out and, you know, they sent me their developer. So that was a really nice thing. And then I remember DMing that person in the Slack channel saying, hey, like, thank you so much for sending them over. They've done such a good job for my client. I'd love to connect with you as well. We got on a call and turns out I was actually flying to Dubai in 2 weeks and they were also flying in Dubai for 2 weeks. So we decided to meet up, hang out, have dinner. We ended up going to the UFC together, which was in Abu Dhabi at the time. So we went and watched the UFC together and now, you know, it's incredible how things just start and flourish online. And, you know, I think it's a mindset. If you feel distance or time is a blocker, it will eventually be a blocker. If you're proactive about it, it will never be a blocker. You can do Zoom meetings.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm sitting in the room with you right now, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I had the experience of first conference I went to post-pandemic. There was a colleague was there who I had only met and talked with on Zoom. She was actually a guest on this podcast as well. But that was the first time we'd met live, but it'd been multiple years of building a relationship virtually. And she walked into the bar where people were gathering and it was this funny moment. I was like, my emotional inclination is to give her a hug because we had this great relationship going, but literally we'd never met physically before. I just waited and she was the one that initiated the hug, which was kind of cool. God, that's kind of remarkable that we were at that, you know, that point of a close relationship and had never actually physically been in the room together.
It's same here. It's like I've had friends, colleagues, all that stuff that I've met where I've never met before, but it's so weird because when you meet them, it just feels like you're just carrying on from your conversation last week.
Look, we already know each other. We were talking about this. We're talking about that. How's this go? All of that.
The only thing that does get me is people's height. Because when you can't see you can't really tell someone's like someone's presence when you're talking on Zoom. So, for example, there have been times where I thought someone was, you know, way taller than they are, but then they're a bit shorter and vice versa. So that's the only thing that's just like, oh, that's interesting.
I'm usually the tallest guy in the room, so I'm kind of used to that one. You can sort of tell, sort of, on Zoom.
Yeah.
New contact, actually 2-hour-long conversations. And I'm like, I asked my buddy who'd met him live, I said, he's relatively short, isn't he? He said, yeah, I actually met live. He's actually relatively short. Like there's a proportion thing that's really subtle. And I suppose camera angle matters and stuff like that. So I take it you think this remote thing is going to work out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's 100%. It's never been a blocker. It was a blocker initially, as in I thought like, oh, like how can I sign client? But then once you've gone and done it once, twice, 10 times, 20 times, it's just like, okay, it's just, you know, it's the way. And the pandemic did help that.
I was just going to say the same thing. I kind of appreciated that outcome of the pandemic because I've been working mostly remotely for 20 plus years, but you couldn't get people, you could not get people easily on a video conference 5-6 years ago.
100%. People were more like, you know, if you think about having to go out, travel to a place, like it takes, you can condense time so much just by.
You can. Yeah. And now that we've all kind of gotten over it, I mean, people used to be, oh, I don't want to be on camera, my hair, I don't have the setup. or what used to irk me was the 15 minutes of tech support just to get the call started. Like, come on. And now post pandemic, this is so normal. Yeah. That it's jarring how fast that changed.
100%. It's like, oh, you want to meet in person? Like people still do that? That's what it's come to now.
Yeah. Well, you flip that over though. I'm assuming you go to some things where you do end up working with people, connecting with people live. Yes?
Of course.
There,
nothing replaces live connection because you crave it as a human, right? We're social beings by nature. When you're cooped up in a room taking meetings, you actually feel like, hey man, like I'd rather actually meet you, you know, share a laugh with you in person rather than continuously engage, you know, like online. So there is an element where because of social, you know, the social nature of humans, still going out to conferences, meeting your friends out is super crucial.
Important. And we're going to have to keep remembering that somehow. I didn't want to forget asking you, and this is a dovetail back into it, I guess. Music is one of the things you really want live. You spent some time working with in music and music management, right?
Yeah. So this was actually before my sales job. So, you know, after university, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I'm going to caveat this very quickly. You know, in your year one or grade one, you have like those grade one calendars of what the kids want to be when they're older, right? So I remember my mom had showed me this little thing and all the kids in my class, everyone was like, I want to be an astronaut, or, you know, like like a kid has audacious dreams. Mine was a guy with sunglasses with a briefcase that said, I want to be a businessman. I don't know why, but
you were headed that way. I love it.
That was, you know, that was the vibe that grade one Sam was on. So long story short, I remember I was at this was the time where I would be, you know, like going out and stuff and exploring, you know, young 21, you know how it is. And we were at like this rooftop lounge, and literally it was packed and there was only one seat left, and it was next to the person who I would end up managing, right? So I sat down there, said, hey man, can I sit here? It's like nowhere else to sit. And I was waiting for a friend of mine to come. We ended up talking, and he told me what he did. The next day, I actually was invited to an opening of an outdoor lounge area at a hotel through a friend of mine. And my friend was sitting with the owner, and I just said, hey, like, do you have a performance, you know, for the night? Because I'm always thinking network, right? Like, I've been drilled into me, like, how can I add value to somebody I've met? Like, this is just the way I always think. So I thought to myself, okay, like, and she's like, oh, I don't have any performance. Like, do you know someone? And a light bulb went off in my head.
Nice.
Called the person I met. Literally, I said, hey, man, like,
before, yeah.
Yeah, like, you have 2 days before this event. Like, are you, you know, like, are you okay to do it? And he said, yeah. We all made it happen, and it was a brilliantly successful event, and it really bought, like, that was the centerpiece to their launch, and that's what got a lot of people coming back. So after that, he asked me, hey, you know, can you manage me? And we went on a journey. So got investments, flew out to Los Angeles, recorded with some incredible people, and that was a good that was a very interesting year and a half of my life. And
wow.
I made no money, but it was great fun.
Well, you brought away invaluable lessons, right?
Exactly.
You know, lack of money in that corner of the universe aside.
Yeah. You could create your life. You are the artist, and you know, you have the brush, and you're limited only by your mind.
It's a hard business, music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really hard business. Even harder now, I think. Than you know, a decade ago or something like that. So my hat's off to the folks that actually kind of stick with it and do it. Wow, that said a lot. That story says a lot about you. Like, that's really cool.
Thank you.
Why'd you, aside from the fact that, you know, getting paid is not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. Any regrets about leaving it? The sort of arts world.
No, not at all. I think my mentality is, you know, whatever is meant to be mine will be mine, even if it's 1,000 miles away. And whatever is not meant for me, even if it's between my lips, it won't be mine. So, you know, if I look back, I would never be where I am now had I not left it, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm very happy with where I am now, the trajectory, the amazing clients that we're working with, the amazing connections I've built. You know, I always say, like, my whole journey, I've just stood on the shoulders of giants. And a lot of people say I'm self-made. I totally don't believe in that, because I think every single person had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pivotal people in their lives that changed the entire course of where they were going to go. So for me, it's really important just to have self-awareness and say, look, I'm here because this is exactly where I'm meant to be in this moment. And just be respectful of the people that got you here, and always, 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 you know, nurture those relationships, because, you know, you'd never be here without that.
Yeah. Nice. Well, that is a hell of a capper. I think we should stop with what you just said, because you actually quoted Isaac Newton. Respect. If I've seen far, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants. Was Newton, and I think it sort of made its way into English after that. But
oh yeah.
So I think you're going to stick around this. I think you're going to stick around this space. Yes.
Yeah. So we're actually building something. One problem we identified is, you know, there are a few brands, let's say from the 0 to 2 million GMV range. And these brands, they struggle with email. You know, they can't, money best spent is not on an agency that charges you. So, you know, that's more of an accelerator than a 0 to 1 situation. Mm-hmm. So the problem we're looking to solve is, how do we take people from 0 to 1? And that's why we're building a software. It's called magicals.com. So really proud of that domain name. I think we got the 1% of the domain names that were available with one word. So yeah, we got that. And we're actually building an AI platform that generates AI emails immediately, entirely on brand. So that is the next journey that we're slowly stepping into.
Interesting.
And,
interesting. Yeah.
Generative AI.
Yeah, go AI. And see, look at that. We waited until like 45 minutes in to end up talking about AI. Because I don't know about you, but I was getting tired of that being every conversational topic. Like, come on, it's not the only thing happening in the world right now. But Wendy, do you have a target date for launch? You already launched?
I think with SaaS, like, that, you know, I think when it comes to launch, that there isn't usually like one day where you unveil the curtains and you launch, right? Because quite realistically, nobody gives a squash about it, right?
Yeah.
Until you make it and get traction. So
yeah,
our goal is to continuously launch,
iterate,
make it better, get feedback, build on the feedback, and just go through an agile model where we're continuously just getting feedback, iterating. Start off with a very close cohort of, let's say, 100 people that we can just very rigorously field test this with more of a white glove approach. Mm-hmm. And then using their feedback, we'll then evolve it into self-serve eventually. So that's the game plan, roadmap.
Nice. I'll be very interested to see how that arcs out. That's
100%.
That's a much needed gap to fill. My snap response is
100%.
Yeah, because that zero to one, that's a tough stage.
It is a tough stage, and what I was thinking is like, you know, Alex Hormozi, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, absolutely, you know,
So you know his value equation, right?
Yeah.
It's like a dream outcome times perceived likelihood of achievement divided by effort and sacrifice time delay. So when I look at it, I thought, okay, so their dream outcome is we want beautiful emails being sent out with a good cadence. If we build this right, it's a very high perceived likelihood of achievement. Yeah. There is no effort and sacrifice because you click a button and it's done and no time delay. So you know, you don't have to wait weeks for it to be done. It's done there and then. You schedule 30 a month in advance of all of your campaigns, fully designed, branded, copywriting.
Wow. Brand.
And then also it will be data driven. So it will read the data of what's performing, not only in your industry, but for your brand specifically. It will feed the AI generative engine this data so that it makes more of what's working. So we're really putting a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into this, but I really do want to disrupt the space with this, you know?
Good for you. Wow. Love it. I'm a SaaS guy, so
yeah,
of course it's going to get me going. Cool.
Yeah, cool.
Well, Sam, we should wrap up, but I am so delighted that we had a chance to connect live, meet live, have this conversation. It seems like it's not going to be the last one we'll have.
Absolutely.
Where does someone come and find you if they say, oh man, that's someone I need to talk to?
You can find us at, you can either find me on LinkedIn under Sam Saifi, or just hit up our website. Revenue Labs with a Z or a Z in America. Revenue Labs with a Z.com.
All right, Sam Saifi, Revenue Labs. We are out. Thanks again.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Matt.